G'day and welcome back to the Australian Histories podcast. Just a quick note, I am recording away from my usual space today, so if you hear any odd noises or the fireplace behind me creaking, don't be alarmed. Today we're going to begin a short series looking at two very interesting men who we can describe as explorers and navigators, men who made some important discoveries for the colonial authorities and literally changed the way we pictured and referred to the continent and islands of Australia. George Bass and Matthew Flinders are names many of us heard in primary school. Soon after arriving in the new colony, they explored areas of the coast around Port Jackson that few white men had yet seen. They were instrumental in confirming the suspected existence of what would afterwards become known as Bass Strait, the channel of water separating mainland Australia from the island of Van Diemen's Land, later known as Tasmania, and were the first to circumnavigate it. Flinders would later circumnavigate the entire mainland of Australia, the eastern New South Wales side of which was generally still called New Holland then, and he led the charge for naming the continent Australia, so we have him to thank for that. Meeting on the voyage out to Port Jackson on HMS Reliance, the two men, having a similar desire and enthusiasm for adventure and exploration, and offering themselves to the Navy for just such opportunities, they seemed to have formed a close bond. Working together at the edges of the known world seemed right up their alley. So we'll explore a little of the background of each man, what drew them to the exploration and navigation, and what they achieved for the colonial and British governments, and for the sailing fraternity beyond. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Vicky G., Chris G., and Fitz once again, whose recent contributions to the show were much appreciated. I also want to thank those who got in touch after the long-delayed release of the Waltzing Matilda episode. I truly do have the most warm-hearted listeners. I loved hearing your feedback, so thanks so much for taking the time. And I promise never to sing lines in a podcast again. Oh, and thanks to Melinda, who got in touch to say the Mawson series helped her to swat up on Douglas Mawson after she chose him as her special subject on the ABC's Hard Quiz. Bravo, Melinda. Almost the last man standing, so very well done. It looks like it was a fun experience too. Now, on with our look at Bass and Flinders. For this first episode, we'll begin by focusing our attention on George Bass, and then reflect on the parallels in the men's lives once we turn our attention to Matthew Flinders. Though the two men grew up in reasonably close proximity, with only a few years between them in age, they only made one another's acquaintance once aboard the ship that brought them both, in service, to the shores of Botany Bay. Oh, no, I said I wouldn't do that. Oh, sorry. Anyway, by then the penal colony had moved to Port Jackson, a much more favourable harbour, the expanding development there soon becoming well known as Sydney. In February of 1795, Captain Hunter, soon to relieve the men of the Rum Corps of their temporary stewardship of New South Wales, set sail in the HMS Reliance, in company with HMS Supply, to take up his position as the new Governor Hunter of New South Wales. His positive and enthusiastic expectations were to be worn down by troubles he would later encounter with the said Rum Corps officers, and you might return to the episodes on Bligh, the Rum Corps, and the MacArthurs, episodes 52 to 55 and then 57, for a refresher on how the early governors fared up against those men. But at least the journey out was full of enthusiasm and positivity for Hunter and his accompanying men. One of the many eager and ambitious midshipmen sailing with him was the 20-year-old Matthew Flinders. Also on board was the 25-year-old ship's doctor, George Bass. Both men were enormously excited by the prospects naval service in the new colony might offer them, particularly in relation to exploration, both being great fans of Cook and Banks. Bass, in particular, formed a very happy and positive relationship with Hunter, which would serve him well in his ambitions. For the first part of the voyage, at least, Bass and Flinders would not have had much opportunity to get to know one another, given their differing ranks and roles on board. Flinders would have been bunking and socialising largely with the other midshipmen. As ship's doctor, Bass would have had his own cabin and surgery area, generally mixing with the more senior-ranked officers on board. But after the ship stopped for supplies in Tenerife, Flinders appears to have been afflicted by kidney stones or inflammation of the bladder and kidneys, anyway some kind of very painful related condition, which then brought him into the care and to the attention of Bass. During this time together, they learned they had both grown up in Lincolnshire, their villages only a few miles apart. During their conversations, they also discovered the great similarities in their backgrounds, their interests in the explorers of the Age of Enlightenment, and their immense desire to be part of it. A firm friendship was in the making. Bass had been born in January 1771 in Aswerby in Lincolnshire. When he was only six, his father died. His mother appears to have initially tried to keep the family farm running, but within a year moved to the nearby town of Boston to be closer to her brother, and later sent George to the Boston Grammar School there. He was clearly a smart lad, and the school was strong in languages, including Latin, and he did seem to be skilled in languages throughout his life, also learning Italian, Spanish, and later some indigenous languages of the Eora Nation of New South Wales. And of course, mathematics and sciences would have been amongst the other subjects that would prove useful in his future career. He even appears to have learned somehow to swim. Indeed, he was a very strong swimmer, which was not a common talent at the time, even for those intending to embark on a life on the water. Boston was a port town in the mid-east coast of England, sited a navigable distance in from what they call the Wash. With all the ships around him, Bass seems to have taken an interest in the sea at an early age, much to his mother's concern. Seafaring was not the safest of occupations in the day, and she seems to have firmly directed him into a career in medicine instead. Various biographers describe the young George as, quote, very bright, curious, and fond of reading, unquote, and that he was a studious youth in the habit of copying verses that appealed to him into his books. His reading tastes seem to largely revolve around the adventures and stories of the intrepid, and he had copies of Cook's Voyage Around the World, Don Quixote, Sinbad the Sailor, and various books on marine disasters and sundry dangers at sea, many of which he annotated with his own observations and thoughts. In one shipwreck book, he made copious notes about the hardships and sufferings that might be experienced at sea. But despite all that potential horror, he was apparently still drawn to such a life. However, his musings written in the book showed he was aware of the distress a seafaring career would bring to his widowed mother, and in his notes he vowed not to do so, quote, while my dear mother lives, unquote. Lincolnshire had produced a great share of Pacific and other explorers over the years, perhaps the most well-known being Joseph Banks, who continued to champion the exploration and, indeed, colonisation of New South Wales. And Matthew Flinders' kinsman, John Franklin, would undertake expeditions in the Arctic, fight in naval battles, and go on to become an accomplished Navy man, and later governor of Tasmania for several years. Afterwards, he would lead another Arctic expedition, hoping to chart the Northwest Passage, though he died in that unsuccessful attempt. And I did do an episode on Lady Franklin, episode 37, which mentioned John's last voyage in its epilogue. As Bass approached adulthood, the pull of opportunities for exploration and discovery became very strong. In an effort to provide her son with a safer career option at home, his mother had apprenticed him to a local surgeon and apothecary when he was just 16, where he would be exposed to and learn the medical profession, such as it was then. It was perhaps an interesting time to go into medicine, you know, on the cusp of so much new knowledge, as the field of medicine was in the Age of Enlightenment, to making some interesting and perhaps merciful leaps forward in the understanding of crucial areas of practice. It was a time of advances in knowledge of physics, chemistry and biology, and in particular anatomy and pathology, all impacting on the understanding and implementation of treatments in the centuries to come. In times past, there was quite a divide between the doctors, or the physicians, and the surgeons, or sometimes barber surgeons. The professions divided along the lines sometimes described as wet and dry. Physicians did not care to deal with blood and guts in the main, but rather focused on symptoms and diseases and undertook their learning in the universities to become doctors. Operations and bloody messy procedures were undertaken by the barber surgeons, and their training was more akin to an apprenticeship, learning by assisting with procedures before undertaking the task themselves. Sounds a bit dodgy, but with hindsight, pretty much no one really knew what they were doing or why, and what harm their treatments and procedures were actually causing. Particularly with blood loss, infection, and poisonings going on all over the shop, with little reliable pain relief, it's no wonder that many suffering opted to forego treatment of any kind. But then, some conditions, like the kidney or bladder stone that ye olde Samuel Pepys suffered in the 16th century, became so painful that he would willingly endure an anaesthetic-free operation that might withdraw the stone in minutes of agony, rather than endure the persistent, ongoing pain. And so he did. How? Anyway, better not head off down that rabbit hole. Back to Bass. So Bass was apprenticed to Boston surgeon and apothecary Patrick Francis. By that time, men like him were generally more well-rounded in their knowledge and qualifications. Francis certainly operated as more of a general practitioner, working as a physician, obstetrician, and surgeon for his community, as well as mixing and selling the medicines his clients required. And this broad practice suited Bass pretty well. Bass worked under Francis for 2 years, learning all he could, and his interest was particularly drawn to the surgery, and so he decided to undertake further training to achieve a surgical qualification, which was by then an available option. A diploma from the Company of Surgeons in London required him to study further in anatomy, surgery, physiology, chemistry, and so on, and he needed to become a pupil at one of the London hospitals to observe treatments there for a period before sitting an exam set by the Company of Surgeons. His apprenticeship with Francis had served him well, and his intelligence and studious approach saw him pass the exam in April of 1789 at only 18 years of age. This gave him the highest accreditation available and permitted him to practice anywhere in England, and bestowed the prestigious moniker of surgical distinction, having Mr. displayed before his name. But rather than set up his own lucrative private practice, he wished then to use his qualifications to advance his other long-standing desire. And though his dear mother did still live, he persuaded her to give her blessing so that he could take to the sea as a surgeon in the British Navy. In June of 1789, he again took an exam, this time before the Court of Examiners for Sea Surgeons, which he passed with flying colours, and was given the highest ranking for a surgeon's mate on a first-rate vessel. Positions, though, were limited to those ships that required a surgeon's mate, rather than just by class or rating, so he would need to work on any class ship that needed him in the short term. His naval career began on HMS Flirt. Great name, sounds like a fun ship. Where he served from June to November. He then moved to HMS Gorgon from November till July the following year. The Gorgon was to sail for Botany Bay, which pleased Bass greatly, but in the end various delays with the ship preparations saw another vessel undertake that voyage. Bass used his time while patrolling the English coasts instead to study additional sailing skills and prepare for promotion. In the following years, Bass served on a number of ships. When he joined the Navy at 18, he was described as 6 foot tall, dark-complexioned, handsome, physically strong, and possessing a fine sense of humour. Indeed, it was recorded, quote-unquote, his very appearance bespoke commanding energy. So not a bad review for his Tinder profile. He was said to be strong-minded, and he loathed inactivity. Indeed, a stimulating career working in a risky environment was his dream job, if only he could get away from the English Channel into far-flung environs. He would spend any spare time studying either medical tracts or learning the skills most useful to sailing, navigation and seamanship, everything from learning a myriad of knots and splicing rope to understanding tides and water movement, and he was reported to have become most adept at handling the small boats too. Well, what a man, eh? Certainly he was well-liked by those recording his life. He came to the attention of Hunter on the voyage out to New South Wales, who was greatly impressed by his well-informed mind, and that impression would bode well for him in being able to pursue his desire for exploration once in New South Wales. Bastian described him physically as an adult as, quote, a tall, dark and handsome man, with a certain haughtiness in his bearing, and his preference for wearing his hair powdered made him look older than his 25 years, unquote. As well as caring for sick and injured crewmen, a ship's surgeon was also responsible for the general health and hygiene of the ship. He might instigate beneficial cleaning, eating and exercise regimes. The larger warships might carry up to 800 men, and hygiene aboard was a constant and very necessary challenge to stave off dysentery and other illnesses. Accidents were common, as well as injury from fighting or punishment. The common practice of flogging as a disciplinary measure could tear the flesh from a sailor's back, sometimes doing enough damage to expose the spine or the rib bones, and healing from such extreme injury was difficult. A ship's surgeon would have to manage the consequences of outbreaks of lice through to treating a crew riddled with venereal disease, all with the rather limited medical kit they had in the day. I think the men who had the conscientious and skilled Bass aboard as their ship's surgeon may have been luckier than most in the Navy. Just as the French declared war again on Britain, Bass sailed to Newfoundland, the British wanting to protect their valuable fisheries there, and he was away for 6 months. Soon after his return, he learned that HMS Supply and Reliance were to embark on a journey to Terra Australis on the far side of the globe, to the colony of New South Wales. And recognising a renewed opportunity to visit the Antipodes, he successfully lobbied for a position on the Reliance. He was beyond delighted. What a great opportunity. Indeed, in a letter Bass wrote to Joseph Banks a number of years later, he explained his desire to join the Reliance for its potential and that once he arrived in New South Wales, it was his intention to, quote, explore more of the country than any of my predecessors in the colony and to procure new or rare specimens of subjects in natural history, unquote. It was the Reliance that would finally allow him to fulfil his desire to explore and take him to New South Wales. Supply and Reliance were to take supplies and livestock to the still struggling colonial outpost at Port Jackson. Bass was given permission to recruit and bring with him a personal servant to assist in his work, particularly as there was not going to be spare labour available for him in the new colony. Bass recruited a London boy named William Martin. In naval language, Martin would be termed Bass's lob lolly boy. L-O-B-L-O-L-L-Y. Lob lolly boy. Now, you know how I enjoy learning a new word in an episode. But really, naval terminology is just too weird, isn't it? Lob lolly boy is completely unfathomable. But as my new word for the episode, I did look it up, and I'm assured that lob lolly boy is the informal name given to the assistant to a ship surgeon in that era. The name derives from the porridge traditionally served to sick or injured crew members. Phew. Well, actually, the term is somehow related to the act or implement used to bang on the porridge pot and stir the porridge. But it's no less weird, is it? In another contender for weird words, I had understood that such an implement was already named by the Scots. They call the porridge stirring implement a spurtle. Not sure what's wrong with calling stuff a spoon, but there you go. Isn't language wonderful? Anyway, lob lolly boy Martin would attend Bass during the voyage as his sort of general dog's body and assisted in the medical work that he undertook. Martin remained in his employment over the next 5 years, proving to be a most resourceful and valuable companion, and perhaps he should get equal billing for some of Bass and Flinders' explorations and discoveries too, seeing as he was an active crewman for many of Bass's outings. Bass also took the opportunity to make known to the soon-to-be New South Wales Governor Hunter his great desire to explore the colony once they arrived. He was reminded that boats free and available for such duty would be rare and in high demand in Port Jackson. So wisely, Bass had got permission to bring a small boat along with him too. Matthew Flinders had a similar trajectory to Bass in making his way onto the Reliance. Like Bass, his great aspiration was to undertake, hopefully, the most exciting of adventures, fulfilling his desire to explore, map and record new lands. Flinders had been born in March of 1774 at Donnington, only 8 miles from Bass's village, and only 3 years later. Donington also had its ties to the sea, manufacturing rope for the British Navy. The eldest of five surviving children, Matthew was a responsible and caring brother to his siblings, their mother dying when Matthew was only 9. As a youngster, he was enrolled in the local free school, also learning Latin, and evidently proving to be a good student. At 12, he was sent off to board at the grammar school in a nearby village, and though no records appear to survive, the writings of his father noted that he performed very well, being, quote-unquote, first boy except one. Being a well-respected family, they had an active social life, and Flinders would maintain fond communications with many family and friends, begging them to keep up return correspondence once he joined the Navy so he would not become lonely. One of the many he wrote to well into the future was Anne Chappelle, a friend of his cousin's, and a fondness was developing between them even as his new career would take him away for long stretches. His father, like his grandfather, was a local doctor at Donington, running the town surgery and apothecary. Flinders' father expected that he would likewise follow in his footsteps. In a less formal arrangement than Bass's, Flinders did work with his father after turning 14, but again, like Bass, his real interest lay elsewhere. Britain's off and on again wars with France would have been an exciting draw for a young boy, and there would have been plenty of sensational stories from cousins and acquaintances who had been involved, particularly those serving in the Navy. But of even greater interest to Flinders, again as they had been for Bass, were the stories of Captain Cook's voyages, a thrill to Flinders. But he later wrote that what really, quote, induced him to go to sea against the wishes of his friends was reading Robinson Crusoe, unquote. And so again, like Bass, Flinders undertook his own studies in trigonometry, geometry, and navigation so that he might become a valuable recruit for the Navy. His father, though, continued to coerce him into medicine, arranging a position for him with a Lincoln surgeon and apothecary named Joseph Bell. But he stayed only 2 weeks there before returning home, his father finally relenting, and Flinders signed up as a 16-year-old midshipman in the Navy. The prospect of both his career decision and his physical departure was a grief for his father, but it was clear that he was quite set on it and the family just had to adjust. It seems his first ship was the Scipio, operating around the coast, and then afterwards the Bellerophon. A midshipman or master's mate is an officer in the Navy, but its lowest rank. Wiki notes midshipmen were expected to work on the ship while learning navigation and seamanship. They were expected to rig sails, keep watch, relay messages between decks, supervise gun batteries, command small boats, and take command of subdivision of the ship's company under the supervision of one of the lieutenants. Midshipmen were instructed by a senior master's mate who taught them mathematics, navigation, and sailing lore. Flinders would be keen to advance onwards to lieutenant, and so enthusiastically absorbed the knowledge and skills that would be attractive to the Navy and to help him in his explorations. To Flinders' delight, a great opportunity arose that would give him his first extended sailing and exploring opportunity. The Admiralty was readying to send Captain Bligh back to Tahiti on the Providence to collect the breadfruit he'd failed to bring home on his first disastrous voyage there. For more background on Bligh and that first voyage on the Bounty, I did include some information in the Bligh and Rum Rebellion episodes, numbers 52 to 55. A trip to and a sojourn on Tahiti in the Pacific could hardly have come closer to the Robinson Crusoe-induced fantasy Flinders had entertained from boyhood, and he applied to join the Providence crew at the earliest. His colleague wrote on hearing of his impending voyage, quote, "I'm pleased to hear you are so well satisfied with your situation on board the Providence. I have little doubt of your gaining the good opinion of Captain Bligh if you are equally attentive to your duty there as you were on the Bellerophon," unquote. As they set off, Flinders would soon have the chance to test all his skills in the untamed environment of the open oceans. At the end of his teens, as a midshipman, he was already displaying a strong sense of duty and honour in his role, but he was still looking to how he could also achieve his personal goals of exploration while in service. At 5'7" in height, slim and wiry, Estenson, in her biography of Matthew Flinders, described reports of him having an alertness about him and possessing deep springs of energy, His countenance, dedication, and enthusiasm to his goals certainly seemed to parallel Bass's, so we can see the similarities in personality, or at least in interests, well before they met. He seems to have done well under Bly, at least in the early days. He got his first view of Australia in February of 1792 when the Providence stopped at Adventure Bay on the east coast of Bruny Island, Tasmania, where they collected water, wood, and rested before making their way onwards into the Pacific. Estenson writes that as they approached Tahiti, the crew readied themselves by doing some drills and target practice, but also in cleaning themselves up in preparation for socializing with the Tahitians. Their hammocks and clothes were repaired and cleaned, their bodies too, one hopes. But most importantly, the surgeon checked all the men for signs of venereal disease, as Bly did not want to be responsible for bringing an outbreak on shore. But of course, it was already rife on the island from all the previous contact with outsiders. When they departed, many of the crew had subsequently acquired, quote-unquote, warm tokens of their affection, as one wag on a separate visit apparently called it. One source suggested that Flinders himself may have lost his virginity there, but gained a troublesome STD instead, the record showing him being treated on two occasions with the marginally effective mercury that was the usual treatment at that time. So while there didn't seem to be too many prohibitions about fraternising while on shore, Flinders did record a number of other rules that Bly insisted on, including regulating any trading that occurred, that the islanders were to be treated well and show no violence, and so on. Relations remained cordial for most of their stay, wearing thin only as the final weeks approached, and this is not surprising, as the striking and preparing of the cuttings took 3 long months. And may have meant Bly's crew were becoming a burden on the local community. What's that rule about house guests staying only 3 days for a harmonious experience? Their return journey was a little less pleasant, with much space and water being used for the precious plants, and Bly, his health having deteriorated somewhat, becoming more prickly. By the end of the voyage, Flinders was convinced that Bly had taken a serious dislike to him. Still, there was a history of changeable impressions of Bly and his behaviour, and feeling unloved was not really an unusual experience amongst those who sailed with Bly. Just ask Fletcher Christian. It's interesting that Flinders felt like that, though, as after they had returned and he was applying for promotion, he produced a very favourable reference written by Bly, which described Flinders as, quote, diligent, sober, and obedient to command, unquote, and noting that he possessed all the necessary skills required by an officer. Well, like him or not, Bly doesn't appear to wish Flinders any impediment to his career advancement anyway. Maybe Flinders was just a sensitive chap, offended by the old, rough captain's behaviour. He wouldn't be the first. On the whole, Flinders had enjoyed the Tahitian service immensely, and he was even more hopeful of continuing opportunities to explore and get involved in natural history expeditions. On the voyage home, they had been able to chart the islands they visited and returned west via the Torres Strait, which Bly had navigated a few years earlier in his open boat after the Bounty Mutiny. It had the potential to be quite the dangerous route, but they travelled carefully and charted as they went, and they made it safely to the western end. During that section, they had some contact with the indigenous people from the areas they sailed through, some aggressive and other encounters more inquisitive and friendly. And they finally made it back to England in one piece, with the order and naval command structure intact in August of 1793. The crewmen arrived just in time to visit their families briefly and then join the newly declared war with France. I'll bet their memories of Tahiti were all the more sweet. By October, Flinders was once again serving on the Bellerophon, and he was involved in a fierce and famous naval battle there with the French, and lived triumphant to tell the tale. By December, Flinders had heard of the impending supply mission to New South Wales. With great luck, he was appointed to the Reliance as a senior master's mate on the ship captained by the respected and well-liked Hunter. It was a mission that might keep him away for 4 or 5 years, and much to his father's disappointment, he also took his youngest brother Samuel on board with him, leaving England early 1795. training under his captain, he would improve his skills in hydrography, using the sextant and timekeeper to calculate various locations, along with practicing other observations required of a navigator. When Reliance's second lieutenant became ill and had to leave the ship at Rio de Janeiro, Flinders had the great fortune to be temporarily promoted to acting second lieutenant, though there were other men more senior to him on board. The position came with the privilege of his own small cabin, and he was able to spend his spare time with the more senior officers. So quite the step up, if only temporary. Once again, like Bass, he had come to the attention of Hunter and was clearly being favoured. And of course, Flinders was now on the same ship as Bass, and in time, as Flinders' medical issues brought him under Bass's care, they would have an opportunity to get to know one another. Flinders was to later record, quote, "In Mr. George Bass, surgeon of the Reliance, I had the happiness to find a man whose ardour for discovery was not to be repressed by any obstacles, nor deterred by any danger. And with this friend, a determination was formed of completing the examination of the east coast of New South Wales by all such opportunities as duty of the ships and procurable means could admit." Unquote. They had the same objective, the same attitude, and considering their options and possible opportunities once they reached New South Wales, would have spent much time discussing their hopeful plans, no doubt. Now, one other exceptionally interesting person sailing on the Reliance with Bass and Flinders was Bennelong, finally making his way back to New South Wales after his extended period visiting England. Port Jackson Indigenous man Bennelong was finally returning home. Wulawawari Bennelong was born into the Wangal clan on the south bank of the Parramatta River around mid-1760s. He and the other Eora Nation's peoples of the Port Jackson area had been immediately disturbed by the arrival of the British with their convicts in 1788, but he later became a very important conduit of communication between the two cultures. Now, Governor Phillip had instructions to form friendly relations with the indigenous populations there, but the Eora people had been largely ignoring and avoiding the white men whenever they could. So Phillip had decided to forcefully hold an indigenous man, Arabanu, in the hope of learning something of their language and culture. But Arabanu was not at all cooperative, and he escaped at the earliest opportunity. "Still, if at first you don't succeed, eh, Phillip?" In November of 1789, it was Bennelong and his clansman Colby who were forcefully abducted and brought to the settlement at Sydney Cove. William Bradley, who painted a watercolour of the scene, which I will put on the Australian Histories Podcast website, described their capture as the most unpleasant service he was ever ordered to undertake. Well, perhaps he wasn't in service long then. Sadly, there were worse actions undertaken in the future. But back to Bennelong. Both men were clearly outraged, but Bennelong did show some interest in learning what he could of the men holding him. Colby escaped soon afterwards, but Bennelong stayed in the settlement for several months before also returning to his people. Bennelong's biographical entry by Eleanor Dark described him as, quote, "an initiated man, about 170 centimetres or 5 foot 6 inches tall, who had survived smallpox. Captain Watkin Tench said he was about 26 years old, of good stature and stoutly made, with a bold, intrepid countenance which bespoke defiance and revenge. He acquired knowledge both of our manners and language faster than his predecessor, Arabanu, had done. He became an important mediator, informant, and cultural broker between the British and his people." Unquote. So within 10 weeks, Phillip had finally learned the names and locations of the local people and the principal Sydney tribes or clans, such as, quote, "the south side of the harbour, from Sydney Cove to Rose Hill, the natives called Parramatta, the district is called Wan, and the tribe Wangal." Unquote. It was recorded that, quote, "Bennelong lives with the governor and is a very intelligent man. Much information can be got from him when he can be better understood." Unquote. And Watkin Tench wrote that Bennelong called Phillip affectionately Bi Nena, father, while Phillip called him Dural, son. But after a couple of more weeks, Bennelong did make his way back to his own people, much to the disappointment of Phillip, no doubt. There are many slightly differing stories about the next incident, but it seems that several months later, Bennelong was amongst a large gathering of clans who had come together to feast on a whale that had beached at Manly Cove. Bennelong sent some blubber to Phillip at South Head, inviting him to join them. Philip was keen to re-establish relations with the Aura there, and Bennelong in particular, and so he made his way there to meet them. Smith's retelling of what happened there stated, quote, "After shaking hands and talking with Bennelong, Philip saw him place a long timber spear, barbed and pointed with hardwood, on the ground. As Philip was about to leave, a sturdy older man snatched the same spear from the ground and hurled it, striking Philip's right shoulder and protruding through his back. In pain, Philip shouted to his aide, Henry Waterhouse, 'For God's sake, haul out that spear!' Waterhouse broke the shaft and Philip reached the boat and was rowed to Sydney Cove, where surgeon William Belmain extracted the point." Unquote. But to his great credit, Philip did not order any retribution, and no further violence took place in relation to the spearing. They were all able to retreat with no further aggression. Some sources suggest Bennelong had arranged this, allowing the deliberately inflicted non-fatal injury to serve as payback for his and Colby's kidnapping. Thus, in the protocol of his people, it allowed an avenue for future communications and meetings. Others seem to think it was a genuine misunderstanding, that Bennelong's friend had rather overreacted. Certainly Bennelong may have prearranged it, and given his friend the signal to act, but he certainly seemed very concerned that Philip had been injured and was attentive to his recovery, visiting him often afterwards at Government House. It is felt that whatever the motive, the intention was never to kill Philip, as at such close quarters any warrior could have ensured a fatal blow, if desired, so more likely it was deliberately inflicted to punish him. Physical punishment of a similar kind was a common part of Eora law and justice. The outcome was that Bennelong's relationship with Philip was renewed, this time entirely by choice. Bennelong, in the end, had quite a friendly and productive relationship with Philip on his own terms, and was greatly interested in learning more about these Europeans who had come into his country. Dark suggested, quote, "Bennelong took readily to life amongst the white men, relished their food, acquired a taste for liquor, learned to speak English, and became particularly attached to the governor, in whose house he lodged." Unquote. Philip gave Bennelong a much-admired red jacket, knives, metal hatchets and a tin shield, and later Bennelong asked the governor to build him his own brick hut. It would be 12 feet or 3.5 metres square, with a tiled roof, built on Tabagool, now Bennelong Point, where the Opera House stands today. He served the colonisers by teaching them about Aboriginal customs and language, and this was intended to mediate relations between the two groups, hopefully to reduce conflict and damage. He maintained good relationships with the colony and became particularly close to Philip, as I mentioned earlier. But there always remained a level of ambivalence about the white settlement, and his arrangements were not always approved of by his clansmen and the wider Eora community. However, his interest in the world of the whites was obvious. A brave and intrepid man, Bennelong, and another Aboriginal man named Yemirawani chose to sail with the departing Governor Philip voluntarily and cheerfully, as one observer recorded, quote, "Notwithstanding the united distress of their wives and the dismal lamentations of their friends, to accompany Philip to England, a place they knew was a great distance from them," unquote, in December of 1792. What a huge and potentially terrifying experience for those two men, totally unaccustomed to the European sailing ships, the vast ocean and the cramped conditions, and the weird food they would have to endure on board. Bennelong's experiences deserve an episode of its own, really. It was May of 1793 before they made landfall in England. They were the first Australian Aboriginals to visit England, and of course, at first, a huge curiosity there. One article stated, quote, "Two sooty natives of New South Wales, brought over by Governor Phillips, caused a stir when they visited the Houses of Parliament at Westminster," unquote. It was also said they were outfitted for a meeting with King George III, and these events would have held some interest for Bennelong at least, but as time wore on, interest in the men ebbed and amusing opportunities would have lessened, and of course they were experiencing more and more homesickness and culture displacement as time went on. Both were badly affected by the English weather and the illnesses they were being exposed to. Yemirawani succumbed to a lung ailment, dying on the 18th of May in 1794, aged only about 19. He was buried there in St. John's Churchyard in Eltham, where a granite headstone was erected for him. Now, when repatriation of his remains was considered in more recent times, it was learned that the headstone was no longer located anywhere near where he may have been buried. And after an investigation, multiple disturbances of the graveyard over the years meant that ever locating and identifying his remains seems unlikely. It was observed at the time that Yamerowani's death severely impacted on Bennelong's mental and even physical health, and it was soon realised that they needed to get him back home at the earliest if he was to survive. Fortunately, the Reliance and Supply were expected to be making such a trip to New South Wales before too long, though the usual delays meant they finally departed many months later than hoped, early in the following year. Smith wrote that, quote, "In January of 1795, after 6 months of confinement on the ship, Captain John Hunter noted Bennelong's precarious state of health and broken spirit. The cold weather had frequently laid him up, and there was apprehension about the state of his lungs. I am doubtful of his living," unquote. After those many delays, HMS Reliance and HMS Supply finally left port. Bass took a great interest in Bennelong's health, working hard to ensure his recovery, and used their time together to learn some of his language and culture, which of course might be helpful when Bass would later encounter people of the Eora Nation while exploring New South Wales. Perhaps Bass's attention and friendship and interest in his culture and language revived Bennelong's spirits as much as any medicine. Either way, he seemed to have been in pretty good shape by the time they all reached Sydney in September. There seemed no further record of his association with Bass after their arrival, but Dark wrote of Bennelong's future, quote, "He reached Sydney in September, and thereafter references to him are scanty, though it's clear that he could no longer find contentment or full acceptance either amongst his countrymen or the white men. 2 years later, he had become so fond of drinking that he lost no opportunity of being intoxicated, and in that state was so savage and violent as to be capable of any mischief." In 1798, he was twice dangerously wounded in tribal battles. A censorious paragraph in the Sydney Gazette records his death at Kissing Point on the 3rd of January 1813. At the time of his capture, his age was estimated at 25, and he was described as being of good stature, stoutly made, with a bold, intrepid countenance. His appetite was such that the ration of a week was insufficient to have kept him for a day, and love and war seemed his favourite pursuits. Contemporary accounts reveal him as courageous, intelligent, vain, quick-tempered, tender with children, and something of a comedian, unquote. But sadly, there was to be no happy ending for Bennelong. So, despite a bit of rough sea on the way out, both Bass and Flinders had managed to spend their time aboard in a very constructive manner, and they reached Port Jackson with a great many ambitions to look forward to. Their relationship with the new governor was happy, and plenty of opportunity lay ahead. They passed through the Sydney Heads on 7th of September 1795 and anchored in Sydney Cove Harbour later that evening. No doubt, Bass and Flinders would have been beside themselves with excitement about all that may lay ahead. So that's how Bass and Flinders made their way to New South Wales. Next episode, we'll talk about how they got on in the new colony. Today, I'm going to recommend ABC's Conversations podcast with Richard Feidler and Sarah Konofsky. They describe their show as spending an hour in someone else's life. Conversations draws you deeper into the life of someone you may have heard about but never met. Have a look at their topics and guests to see if anything takes your fancy. As always, I'll provide a link on my webpages. So thanks so much for listening. I'll now continue working on Bass and Flinders after they arrive in New South Wales, and I'll get the next pod out to you as soon as it's done. Take care. I'll talk with you all again soon. Cheers.